Today is a very exciting day in this class. And again, as sort of the world may be crazy around us, Shabbat is sort of our anchoring constant that's accompanied us from day seven of the world. So hopefully it'll be a little comforting to learn this material. Today we're going to move to the first real code of Jewish law that is of Maimonides. Last week we got a little taste of some earlier kinds of legal work in the Gaonic period. So that Gaonic period is sort of that bridge between the Talmud and the medieval period. There wasn't any comprehensive kind of code of Jewish law. We saw Alfasi, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi last week, known as the Rif, who's in North Africa in around 1000, who does work through the entire Talmud and sort of cuts the stuff that doesn't seem relevant for the law, but it's still organized around the Talmud. It's not like if I want to look up the laws of Shabbat, I would find everything in one place. We do have other Gaonic works that are on specific topics, like the laws of, actually the laws of contracts. There's quite a lot of trade happening with Jewish merchants who are in all different places around then. So there's quite a lot about laws of contracts at that time. And the laws of Shechita, of how to sacrifice, but there's no comprehensive work in that time period. And so what we're going to look at today is Maimonides, the Mishnah Torah. Maimonides, who is in Spain, though later exiled. I saw the statue of Maimonides when I had the treat of visiting Cordoba when I was in college. He's the first to really develop a comprehensive code of Jewish law, though I'm using the word code, someone in quotes, because there's some debate around whether code of law is the best way to approach Maimonides' work. In many ways, it might make more sense to talk about it as a kind of anthology that's topically oriented. He says in his introduction that he's modeling this work after the Mishnah. The goal was to write it in clear and accessible Hebrew, to have it organized by topic. But he also offers his own specific rulings in many of the places, and actually sort of decides which way the law should go, rather than just bringing the various traditions that appear in the Talmud. Okay, it's arranged into 14 sections known as Yad HaChazaka. Yad, the word hand, having the gematria of 14, so the strong hand. And I'll say, looking at how Maimonides organizes his code is in and of itself fascinating. We know that one of the influences on Maimonides was a sort of proliferation at the time in the world of Islam to have Muslim works that were kind of presenting law as law, and that was usually presented as kind of rooted in particular theories and principles. So Maimonides, even though he says he's modeling his work after the Mishnah, does not start where the Mishnah starts. The Mishnah starts with Brachot. That's the first tractate. It's about blessings. Maimonides does not jump in there. In fact, the first thing Maimonides does is counts all of the mitzvot. We have Sefer HaMitzvot that just enumerates what are all of the different mitzvot. And then the first section is actually Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah. Right? What are the foundations of the Torah? And that's essentially some combination of physics and metaphysics before you can even learn the specifics of halacha. And that is sort of meant to be the roots. That's all in Sefer HaMada, the book of knowledge, that seems to be a sort of, there's an epistemological claim there that you sort of can't get into any of the details of Jewish law without understanding the roots and fundamentals. And again, he's sort of drawing on the kind of comprehensive synthetic picture that he's inheriting from or participating in with Muslim philosophers and philosophers of law around him. Okay, so besides that sort of larger organizational structure, right after Sefer Hamada, the book that is devoted to knowledge, you get Sefer Ha'ahava, the book of love. So beautiful. There's no Masechet Ahava in the Mishnah. There's no tractate about love in the Mishnah. This seems to be based on the Shema, right? V'ahavta, you should love your God, and all the things that are incorporated with that, in that we say in the daily Shema in terms of prayer, blessings, laws of the Shema. So things that seem to be dedicated to our sort of daily consciousness of being in relationship with God, that Sefer Ha'ahava. And I also think it actually intersects with, I don't know if how many people here have studied anything about Islam. I've studied only a little bit, but the practice of dhikr, like zecher in Hebrew, to be constantly remembering and aware of God. It seems like Sefer Ahava, in the way Maimonides presents it, is kind of a parallel idea. What are the Jewish laws that are about a sort of daily and even minute by minute consciousness of being in relationship with God? Okay, so we could talk about that more. But even within any specific area of law in Maimonides, looking at the organizational structure is super worthwhile and helpful to understand what Maimonides thinks the kind of meaning of a particular area of law is, right? And I say that because often there's not a ton of extra insight or even numerically extra words that Maimonides brings in this code compared to what you would already find in the Mishnah or in the Talmud, or in, he sometimes brings Gaonic traditions. It's not like a creative work from scratch. Often the language is literally just coming straight out of the Mishnah or the Talmud, but the organizational structure can often be quite creative. Okay, so as we're gonna do some sections of the Mishnah Torah, the Maimonides collection of the laws for Shabbat, and we're gonna focus a lot on the organizational structure here and what we learn about that. And from here, as we move on next week to a later code of Jewish law, the Tor by Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, that's, you know, a couple, not quite a couple, but at least a century and a half later. We'll see, we'll be able to compare their organizational structure. Okay, so here we go with Maimonides, the Mishnah Torah, the moment you've all been waiting for, though you might not have known you were waiting for it, just to sort of worth it to do all of this build-up because, you know, in terms of feeling oriented to exploring Jewish law in the future, Maimonides' Mishnah Torah is your best friend. It's sort of designed so that you can be curious about some area in Jewish law, you can pick it up, learn that section, and feel oriented in that topic in a clear and accessible way. Okay, any questions before we dive into the actual content for today? I hope I've sold you on the importance of studying Maimonides and Mishneh Torah. Yes, Alex.
Is there a does Maimonides like have a Sefer Shabbat, or like what is the sort of guiding principle that
Oh,
like is
okay,
put
great.
there?
Excellent. So, right. So one of these 14 sections is zmanim, times. Times, festivals, that includes Shabbat. Thank you for asking. Yeah, obviously with something like this, like actually the hard work is often knowing what's in each section. So that's the larger section. So we're starting here with chapter one in his Laws of Shabbat. Shvita b'shvi'im imelacha mitzvat aseh, shene'amar v'yom hashvi'i tishbot. Okay, so resting on the seventh day of the week, it's a positive commandment. And he brings the verse, on the seventh day you shall rest. Okay, so framing this primarily as the positive commandment before we're going to get to a negative commandment. V'chol ha'oseh b'melacha bitel mitzvat aseh ve'avar alot aseh. If you do work on this day, you are negating a positive commandment. You're not resting, and you're supposed to be resting. You're also transgressing a negative commandment because we have another pasuk, lo ta'aseh chol melacha, you should not do any work. Okay, so that's our opening two verses, positive commandment, negative commandment, right? And this ties to that introductory project to the Mishnah Torah, which is to enumerate what are all of the commandments, to tie every commandment to a specific verse in the Torah and count to 613. So each section starts by connecting that area of law to the relevant verses in the Torah. Okay, That is both kind of grounding and orienting in general, but also seems to be, to some extent, some kind of polemic or response to Karaites at the time, our non-rabbinic Jews who are living and even living with great vitality at this time. They were more vibrant in the previous Gaonic period, but continue to be a relevant sect in Maimonides' time as well, who reject the oral Torah. So for Maimonides to firmly ground Shabbat in biblical verses and every area of law in biblical verses is critical to the project and to make sure not to sway those who might think rabbinic law is a farce and has nothing to do with the Torah. Okay. I will also say, if you want to compare this to the Mishnah, right, Maimonides here is emphasizing milacha right off the bat, work. Remember, our Mishnah started off with that kind of liminal case about transferring an object, the owner of the house, the poor person outside the house. It was about objects. And we were saying actually much of the Mishnah is in a more object-oriented approach to Shabbat. We see here Maimonides doubling down on this milacha, right, labor approach to Shabbat. Okay, now look at what comes next. What penalty does one deserve for doing work? Okay, what is at stake when one does work? Right, you have nothing in the Mishnah that has this kind of overarching general question. Okay, so we also had nothing in the Mishnah at the beginning that tied it to the Torah. So the two things that the Rambam, who's modeling his code on the Mishnah, does are actually not like the Mishnah at all in how he's framing this. So here we get his general rule of how to understand the penalties for working on Shabbat. There's three categories here. If you did something voluntarily and willfully, birtzono, bizadon, then one is chayav karet. They deserve karet, excision. There's lots of debates about what that means exactly, being cut off from the Jewish people. It's severe. It's like the same as one who doesn't engage in brit milah. Okay, lots that we could say about karet, but that's the idea. But it's something that's sort of between you and God, ultimately. If one acted in the presence of witnesses who forewarned them, one is stoned. So this is what we saw in the Torah. It's a death penalty offense, very severe. But there's a requirement, as in all areas of Jewish law, for witnesses and warning. And finally, if one acted unintentionally, b'shogeg, then one brings a standard sin offering, chatat. Okay. Now, that is all just trying to give you specifics as to what the word chayav indicates, the idea of being culpable, liable, that there's some sort of penalty. We have those three things. And really, one of the main takeaways here is this kind of synthetic introduction before getting into any of the details, but this is characteristic of Maimonides and not characteristic of the Mishnah, right? And again, partly coming as an outgrowth and participating in this larger synthetic approach to law in the Muslim culture around him as well. Okay, gonna do a little bit more here on this kind of terminology, and then we'll have some more a chance for comments or questions. Okay, we're gonna get even more detailed. We're now gonna get a guide to how to understand what you might think of as somewhat anarchic or chaotic terminology in the Mishnah and in rabbinic sources in general. Okay, he's gonna delineate what does the term chayav mean? Right, liable when you see that in the rules of Shabbat. And that relates to what he just laid out, three different possibilities. But then you have language in the Mishnah that says patur, exempt. So here he says any place where it is stated that one who does this thing, a particular action, is going to be exempt, patur, that means that he's exempt from excision, from stoning, or from a sacrifice, those three possible penalties. But it is still forbidden to do this thing on Shabbat. The prohibition being rabbinic as a distancing from forbidden work. Okay, so we're seeing here that there's actually tiered levels of the halacha here in Shabbat. We had something that is forbidden and one is liable for it, chayav, because it is a Torah level offense. And we have patur, what we would call patur aval asur. You're exempt, there won't be a penalty, but you still shouldn't do it. That's rabbinic distancing you from other melacha, right? Again, you can see sort of the structure here is to tie that back to the labor that is more directly a Torah derived and Torah level status labor, laying out the foundations of how we have an expanded rabbinic system that's still rooted in this biblical prohibition not to do work. So again, thinking about this in response to Karaites of the time, all sorts of things that you might look at and say, that's not work, but it's still forbidden on Shabbat, right? He's framing that that's because it distances you from doing work, so it's still tied to the verse and concern about work. Okay. There is a punishment here, makat mardu, lashes of rebellion. That's what Maimonides applies to anybody who violates rabbinic law in that time period of, to what extent this was happening or not, but some kind of vision of the possibility of corporeal punishment. Okay, different times. So you can also have the language of ein osin, right? We don't do something, that means it's forbidden, but not culpable. And then finally, we have the language of mutar, that something is entirely permitted. So we have three statuses here: chayav, forbidden and liable; patur, forbidden but exempt, rabbinic status; and finally, mutar. Okay, that is the sort of synthetic structure just into the terminology of Shabbat that the Rambam uses to introduce this. Any questions so far on this? I realize like this might not be the aspect of Shabbat that resonates most in laying out these punishments, but I hope that you can all see from a kind of legal theory perspective, right? He wants clarity in terminology. And I will add, for people who like to do text critical work, which does include me and my sort of PhD in Talmud side, he's actually making a very neat picture around sources that could be much more chaotic. So sometimes actually when you look at a rabbinic source and it says that something is asur, it's forbidden, it's not actually totally clear whether it means it's forbidden and you'd be exempt, or it's forbidden and one would be culpable. Sometimes it's a little bit messier, but he wants this extreme clarity in terminology.
Could you talk a little bit about the difference between patur and ein osin, those categories?
Right, so that I think is one category. It's just that it's two different, there's two different terms that lead to that same category. So patur and ein osin, he's combining as asur. I will say that what's interesting about that, again from a text critical perspective, is that there could be times where the Mishnah says patur, exempt, and actually in that particular case, the thing is also mutar, it's permitted. There are some Mishnayot, or if you look at them, it seems like patur could actually correlate with mutar. So I think it could be a little bit messier, but he's deciding to put patur and ein osin, right, that exemption and rabbinic level prohibition in one clear category. So that's a choice. This next part is both, in some ways, even more technical, but also kind of fascinating, and fascinating that Maimonides puts this right up front in chapter one. What we're going to get here, starting with this paragraph on the bottom of page one, things that are permissible, is a theory around intention, the relationship between work and intention. And this emerges from the Mishnah, but he is putting a kind of synthetic frame and sort of theoretical frame on it that would not leap out at you in the Mishnah, though there are certainly many scholars nowadays who think that the importance of subjectivity is actually very critical in the Mishnah. And again, sort of in this time period, in the sort of late antique time period, where subjectivity and sort of the importance of inner thoughts is becoming more and more important and kind of articulated both in law and actually in narrative, even the development of sort of a subjective character who has some kind of inner monologue is maybe part of this full picture. So we're going to see here how Shabbat actually becomes a kind of opportunity to think through the complexity of intention and subjectivity, the relationship between intention and action. Okay, and remember that this is partly very important because he just laid out at the top that we have an important distinction between shogeg meizi, doing something accidentally or purposely. So things that are permissible to do on Shabbat, but it is possible that while doing it, one will do forbidden work through it. And it's also possible that it will not be done. So you're doing something on Shabbat that's totally fine. We're going to see an example in a second. It's possible that coinciding with that, there will be a forbidden melacha that will happen, but it's not inevitable. So if one does not have intention to do that particular work, if you have no interest in that forbidden labor happening as an outcome, and it's not inevitable that it will happen, then it is permissible to do the thing you want to do. What's our example? This is going to sound perhaps totally mundane and ridiculous to even think about, but it's okay. It's going to zone us in on this kind of thinking. How is this? What's an example? One may walk on top of grass on Shabbat so long. Oh, I tried to gender neutralize my whole thing, but I forgot one here. So long as one does not intend to uproot it. Hence, if they are uprooted, one need not be concerned. Okay, it's Shabbat. There's not like paved sidewalks everywhere. You're walking on grass. You're just trying to walk. You're allowed to walk on Shabbat, especially if we're not in our more Second Temple context where you should just be stuck inside all day. But when you're walking, it's possible that your shoe might cause some grass to come out of the ground, right? From a technical perspective, that looks like you're doing an act of harvesting. Harvesting is one of our 39 labors. You're uprooting something, picking it. But since you are not interested in harvesting grass, you're just trying to get from point A to point B, you're trying to walk, and it's not inevitable that with every footstep that you take, grass is going to be uprooted. You don't have to be worried about whether, in fact, you did uproot grass. What you are doing is not at all connected to that outcome. You're totally exempt from that outcome. Okay, that's called davar she'eino mitkaven, something that you have no intention for, and it's also inevitable. Are we good with that example, the grass example? Okay, great. Now we'll get to our chicken. But if one did an act and forbidden work is done through it, such that it is certain that it would be done from that act, it's inevitable that that forbidden thing would follow, one is liable, even if one did not intend to do the work. For it's well known that it is impossible that this work would not be done through the intended act. Okay, you can't kind of with a straight face say you didn't intend that to happen. You know it's going to happen as an outgrowth of something that you are actively and intending to do. How is this? This is our example called psik reshe, cut off its head. If one needs the head of a chicken for an infant to play with, so we have a scarcity of toys, and cuts off its head on Shabbat. So you're like, my kid, they're crying, they need to be entertained, I'm going to cut off the head of a chicken so that they have a nice ball to play with. We can talk about whether that seems appropriate from a tzar balei chayim perspective. Is it causing pain to the animal? But in any case, it seems like this might have been something that they did at the times. Even though the end purpose is not solely to kill the chicken, you're not trying to kill a chicken, one is liable, since it is well known that it is impossible to cut off the head of a chicken, of a living being, and it should live, right? Then it would live. And actually killing an animal is forbidden on Shabbat. Okay, so that's our example of the limits of saying I didn't intend for this to happen. If it's inevitable, you are actually going to be held accountable, even if it was not, even if it was not intended. Now, okay, we're looking at, you know, is there any way to contextualize this? This example, it's coming from earlier sources, so this is just the example that exists. I'm not sure to what extent this is historically people actually did play with chickens, and to what extent, right, it's trying to make a rhetorical point. What do you mean you didn't expect the chicken to die? And It's possible that it is actually trying to be a little bit of an absurd example. That's maybe a go-to example rhetorically for making that point. There have been different articles written about like what is, how do we understand this phrase? Maybe we've been misunderstanding it. But in any case, for our purposes, the idea is that it's actually trying to make a very strong and dramatic rhetorical point that you cannot claim with a straight face. You didn't intend for this to happen. Okay, this may feel, I don't know, more or less compelling as you're thinking about Shabbat, but ultimately, as we kind of go through the different examples here, and there's many, we're not going to look at all of them in full. We have different ways of relating my intention and my intended action to what I'm, right, when I am and am not liable and held responsible for the outcomes. So we'll just look at this kind of last paragraph in this particular section here. Anyone who intends to do forbidden work, but a different forbidden work that you did not intend to do is done, you're exempt from it because you didn't fulfill your initial thought. If you wanted to pick black figs, which is a problem on Shabbat, it's harvesting, instead you picked white figs. That's not great, but actually there's not full culpability for that because you did not fully execute your intention. And that's where you get this language of the Torah only prohibits thought out, deliberate work, melechet machshevet. I'll add here that there's a discussion, it's actually brought here, I didn't bring everything here, but if somebody is trying to kill one person and instead kills a different person, there's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin that talks about this, would they get the death penalty even though they had no intention to kill that particular person? Right? Obviously, it's a horrible thing, but in terms of being held accountable for, first degree murder, to use our language nowadays, it would not be considered a case of a first degree murder because there's some sort of gap in intention in the rabbinic system. That's sort of taking us a little further afield, but you can see how Shabbat actually becomes a sort of site, a legal theoretical site to play out these questions of intention and action. How much should I be held accountable? And you can think about applying this to all sorts of other areas of life. Does it apply? Does it not apply? There are some different rules in other areas of law around causing damage, right, in Ezekiel, where we are held accountable more, even if we didn't have full intention. But I think already, sort of, as you think of, sometimes we dip into the legal canon not just to know the specifics of the area of law, but to kind of think with the texts. And I think that this particular example of what are different things in your life, what are different scenarios where, you might not fully intend a particular consequence or outcome, when should you be held, or when should you think of yourself as responsible nonetheless? And when is it fine to kind of divorce yourself from that outcome? That can actually be a very fruitful exercise to explore more widely. I'll add just one more piece here. Mit asik is like a category that's even kind of in a more on another end of the scale here, beyond doing something accidentally or unintentionally. Anyone who does forbidden work while unaware of their actions, being totally preoccupied, and you didn't intend it at all, in fact, you weren't really intending to do anything active in that moment, one is exempt. You're totally patur. Okay, this is, remember, thinking of this, to go back to our grass example, if you're not walking on the grass, let's say you're just sort of sitting and having a conversation with somebody and you end up pulling out grass, you're not even aware of what you're doing. You're not thinking about it at all. Or you walk into a room and just out of muscle memory flick on a light switch, but weren't thinking about, like, you had no actual intention to do that. But that's in our category of mitasik. It's not even that there's some level of conscious mistake. There's totally preoccupied, not thinking about that at all. And in that case, one is totally exempt, okay? In contrast to somebody who might do a labor on Shabbat, forget that it's Shabbat, but know exactly what they're doing, right? Somebody who lights a fire on Shabbat just because they thought it was Tuesday, or you need that level of knowledge in order to even get into the category of shogeg, of doing something by accident. If there's zero intention at all, it's this mitaseh category on the other end. Okay, there's more here on intention, and we won't get through all the details, but I just want to share, right, it is actually quite interesting that Maimonides starts off the code with this kind of theoretical approach to kavana, to intention and action, before we can get into any of the specifics of the laws of Shabbat. And I want you to appreciate that in contrast to the Mishnah that sort of dove right in around laws of carrying. There's all sorts of ways you can bring home this theory of, well, I didn't know that was going to happen. Don't hold me accountable. I didn't know that was going to happen. Right? When can we say that, and when can we really not say that? I didn't know people weren't going to be able to vote if I only made one voting station in a large area. Okay, we'll go on. Another principle that is important here that I just wanted to highlight is towards the bottom of page 2. All that destroy are exempt. It's our last paragraph on page 2. Kol ha-mekalkalin p'turin. This is, so we've seen this, there's the deliberate, right, intentional framework of the action on Shabbat, Melachat Machshavet. It also has to be constructive. Right? The labors on Shabbat are not really forbidden as kind of actions in and of themselves. They're forbidden as part of constructive work. So there are some examples here around if you cause injury to somebody or tear clothing, burn clothing, right? Just sort of smash something, maybe in anger. That's could be not great for all sorts of reasons, but it actually doesn't count as milacha on Shabbat. The problem on Shabbat is constructive labor. There is a caveat here, which is kol ha-mekalkel amenat letaken chayav. That's on the top of page 3. If you destroy in order to improve or to build, then one would be chayav. So if you break something down in order to build it, right, in order to build something new right there, then that is going to be forbidden. And there's all sorts of interesting things in the Talmud about what counts as a constructive purpose. Could an emotionally constructive purpose also count as something that is letakein, that reframes an action as a potential Shabbat violation or not? Right? Very interesting. But those are two, right? We're sort of seeing two contextual pieces on how we understand labor. Melechat machshavet has to be intended, and it has to be constructive. Okay. That's sort of the bulk of what I wanted you to see in chapter 1 in the synthetic framework Maimonides offered. Okay, we're not going to do a lot of chapter 2 here, but I just wanted to give you the sort of overarching framework here as we think of the outline of the rest of the organizational structure of Hilchot Shabbat for Maimonides. Chapter 2, Dichuya hi Shabbat etzel sakanat nefashot kishaar kol ha-mitzvot. Like all other commandments, Shabbat is overridden by danger to life. Okay, this is also a very interesting choice to bring this in an introduction to Shabbat, right? Before we've listed what the labors are that are forbidden. Part of this more synthetic and framing introduction is you have to know before you even learn what's forbidden on Shabbat that none of that matters when somebody's life is at stake. Now this also, right, we can sort of, we spent a little bit of time with some of the Second Temple material in our first day. I don't know how many of you remember this, but there was one version of a Second Temple text there that said, if somebody's in a pit, you cannot use a ladder or a rope to save their lives. because ladders and ropes, you can't touch them on Shabbat. It's not clear that actually that is the version. There's been some debate in scholarship about maybe it says you can. But in any case, it seems like there may have been early interpretations of Shabbat that thought Shabbat trumped human life. And we have discussions in the Talmud that seem to be, there's so many articulations of how you know that Shabbat overrides danger to life, that it seems like it was contested at the time. And so Rambam wants to make sure front and center that you know that Shabbat is overridden by danger to life. We know that sometimes some of the Second Temple sectarian approaches to Jewish law are also, right, sort of make their way into Karaite approaches to Jewish law. I'm not actually 100% sure if that's true around this issue of whether Shabbat is overridden by a danger to life, but it seems like there must have been some extent to which this was contested in Maimonides' time period that he feels like it's critical to highlight this. Okay, and there's also some of the early Christian overtones around the Sabbath made for man or man made for the Sabbath, where we know there were some Jewish Christian debates about this. Okay, so that's chapter 2. You can spend more time with that on your own if you'd like. It's really a lot about illness. Right? We also know, I should add this, maybe one of the other reasons Maimonides emphasizes this is because he himself is a physician. And he, right, you can see this on your own, but he stresses that if there's some need to respond to an issue of danger, that's not something that rabbis should try to avoid and sort of let other people do who maybe don't care about Jewish law as much. He brings the example of women or children in his own time period. He's like, no, we need to be proud and confident and leading the way to show that Shabbat is overridden whenever there's a concern to Jewish life. Wherever there's a concern about danger to life. Okay, one of his examples, I just scrolled to it, is about the case of war, a siege, that if there's a siege and there's lives at stake, then you, of course, take arms and respond. And this also seems to be, right, there are some early sources, particularly in the Maccabees, where we know that there were Jewish sects that actually did not defend themselves on Shabbat. Any comments or questions on that piece before we do our final few minutes here? These sort of two chapters of introductory framework before we get into the rest of the meat of the material. Right? Recall that we didn't see anything early on in the Mishnah about Shabbat being overridden by danger to life. Right? Again, Maimonides' insights here, most of what he puts in that chapter is from discussions in the Talmud about Shabbat being overridden by a concern for life. The words aren't particularly new, but again, it's that organizational structure that's particularly creative. In our last minute, we're going to look at the rest of Maimonides on the Laws of Shabbat. We're going to do a quick little overview. Once we have gotten those important introductory frameworks out of the way, Chapter 3 in Maimonides actually does look like a little more like the Mishnah chapter 1, sort of a timeline now. What are things you can start before Shabbat, work you can start before Shabbat? Even though it won't be finished by Shabbat, we saw in the Mishnah the idea of can you dye right with ink? Can you set that up before Shabbat? Does it have to finish? That was a Hillel Shammai debate that we rooted in this object-oriented versus work-oriented picture. We see here that Maimonides sides with Hillel, not unsurprisingly, and that you, as long as you won't be doing any work on Shabbat, it can continue to do work. But in any case, we see here that now there are chapters in the Mishnah Torah that follow a little bit more closely with the Mishnah, the question of cooking in chapter 4, right? What can you bury your food in to have it stay warm? Chapter 7 is when Maimonides actually delineates all of the 39 labors and discusses them through chapter 12. Chapter 13 is where he starts his discussion of carrying objects, because that's the last of the 39 labors, and that extends all the way through chapter 20. So you can see, right, there's so many chapters on that one particular concern. That's he sort of puts all those object-oriented concerns, right, nestles them in an approach that's really more structured around milacha, around labor. And then finally, in chapter 21, we get to the things that are not explicitly and directly about milacha, about labor. The Torah says you should rest even from things that do not involve labor. There are many things the rabbis forbade on account of resting, shavuot. These include things that are similar to labors, and things that are forbidden because one might come to do a labor worthy of the death penalty, but then we'll see what we're going to spend time on Thursday are things that really seem like they have nothing to do with labor, with milacha, and yet are still forbidden on Shabbat. So hopefully you get a sense of Maimonides' framework really doubling down on the milacha, right, the labor-oriented approach to Shabbat. Everything else is going to be seen as somewhat subsidiary within that, and we'll look more at that next time. But I hope you got a sense here of how Maimonides frames the laws of Shabbat and that sort of more theoretical, synthetic approach to how we define melacha and how we define, in particular, our own intention, internal thought process in relation to the actions that we do. So with that, I'll send all of us off until Thursday. I hope that we have smooth, calm transition between now and Thursday. I look forward to seeing you then and hope that if nothing else, this learning can both prepare us more for Shabbat and also help us think through our own intentions and taking more accountability, responsibility for our actions.